The average agriculture producer has two sides to him or her. There's that lone wolf side, that self-made man or woman, the type of person who can get the job done, doesn't matter if it's managing thousands of acres or hundreds of cattle. But then there's that pack animal side. I haven't met a producer yet who's not willing to turn their entire day upside down just to help out a neighbor with a branding, harvest, or pouring concrete. In the agriculture community, there's a really strong sense of community that I don't think you'd find anywhere else. In today's episode, we're going to talk about that pack animal side, specifically how producers can work together to form a farming cooperative in order to save costs and minimize their environmental footprint. And to help us out, Seth Leon, who's the manager of co-op services at the Alberta Community and Cooperative Association, is going to walk us through the process of creating a farmers cooperative. My name is Derek Leahy, and this is Rural Routes to Climate Solutions. All right, Seth, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Let's start with that first question. We'll just deal with the elephant in the room, which is not Kyle, who's doing all the nice audio recording for us today. The elephant in the room is, you run a cooperatives association. I do a podcast that's all about climate solutions. Why are you here? How are cooperatives a climate solution?
Right. Well, off the hop, I'd say co-ops in and of themselves aren't a climate solution. They're a limited liability corporation. It's a way for people to own and control an enterprise together. So really, when we look at the structure, we can't just say, oh, we'll start a bunch of co-ops and we'll address this issue. However, I'd say, given the structure of a co-op, that they're well equipped to be able to address these things. So that was a bit of a long, rambly start to it. But when we look at things, co-ops do a really good job at localizing solutions and building things to scale to address a local problem. So if we're looking at climate change issues, cooperatives provide a vehicle for people to invest locally and put their time and effort and their money into things that can address the issues that are important to them. So if we're looking at agriculture and looking at more sustainable ways of production, co-ops could play a big role in that piece. The other side to it is that co-ops could play a role in terms of purchasing land and the use of land for, again, more sustainable forms of production. And as well, there's, you know, when you form a co-op, you're building a strong network, and there's a ton of information sharing, and a lot of this work, I'd say, in the climate change field, sometimes it can be a bit isolating. But when you own the infrastructure together, you see, tons of network externalities. And if we're looking at energy transition or these, moving the needle, as they say, co-ops are built for that.
Sweet. Yeah, I guess there's probably some environmental implications, too. And you just think of, like, I know you have a co-op and you have one food truck going into town as opposed to each farmer sending his own truck. In a way, I guess you can minimize your carbon footprint too, I'm assuming.
Exactly.
And just a really quick follow-up question to that one. So we focus on climate solutions a lot on this podcast, but we also talk about farm solutions. So what are some of the benefits for farms and ranches to form their own cooperative?
Right. So, I guess that last answer was pretty broad. But really, so if we look at a lot of big parts of the co-op sector are related to agriculture. So we can see, farms like United Farmers of Alberta or value-added processing co-ops, things like Ocean Spray and, Blue Diamond Almonds. I mean, those are all ag producer co-ops. Really, it's just building it to the scale that would have climate solutions embedded within it. So we could see producers, groups like YYC Growers, where you have urban farmers and, mixed producer farms just outside of Calgary that they're owning the distribution pieces. And then the other is, purchasing the inputs. And then I guess the other would be things like, a cooperatively owned abattoir where you can get out of maybe the larger, kind of an alternative to things like Cargill's and larger feedlots. And it would be built to the local scale as well as being able to do things like organics and making that more cost effective. So those might be some of the solutions that are there.
Okay. And are there any success stories in Alberta in relation to cooperatives? And I know you mentioned a few already, but any ones that really, really stick out in your mind?
Right. So, yeah, that's as I mentioned, local YYC Growers and Distributors Co-op, that's a great example here in Calgary. The others, Sangudo Opportunity Development Co-op, and they were able to invest in a meat processing facility. They were able to build that business out as well. A lot of their customers are doing grass-fed, and they're providing meats to, local businesses and kind of closing that loop and making it smaller. There's a huge, a lot of grazing co-ops. So again, land management, that it's owned and controlled by ranchers. So they're the ones that know best and that are really committed to keeping that land for grazing. And then currently, groups that such as the Alberta Solar Co-op, Local Investing YYC, and other groups that are raising capital to invest in things like renewable energy and social enterprise that would also, embed that, social impact or, having green targets in how they invest locally.
Nice. And actually, we talked about this one the other day too, the Battle River Railway Co-op. That's a really cool story. I don't know if you want to talk about that one a bit.
Definitely. Yes. Yeah. Thanks for reminding me. That's
all good.
So the Battle River Railway is a really great co-op story. Farmers were not receiving the best service on a spur line in outside of Camrose. That line was being serviced by CN, and they were going to shut it down. So the farmers decided to buy it, and since then they've been able to improve the service. The amount of cars that roll through there is probably, I'd say, like two or three times as much as before. As well, they've been able to diversify into things like tourism. And the other part, and I think, this is what we were talking about yesterday, is that for a farmer, owning part of the supply chain and a key piece in the distribution and transportation gives them control in terms of the price that they can get for the product, as well as the transportation costs that they're facing. So when we're looking at climate solutions or other pieces, owning a key piece of the infrastructure is really, really important. And there's a lot to be learned from this example, not just, whether you want to buy a train or a grain elevator or another part of the production process. The other piece too is that you think of this idea of working together, that it's not just sharing information. You actually own a business together, and you're connecting your success to your neighbor's success. When you're looking at these big challenges, I mean, it would be hard for one of those farmers to buy a railway, but together through the community ownership, they were able to achieve this much bigger goal. It'd be interesting to see how the conversations that they're having about, what the future looks like to them compared to farmers that don't own part of the supply chain or have that security, as well as, it's pretty incredible that they own a train and they get it to market, and it's been working. So it's a really, really great example.
Yeah, that one still completely blows my mind. Now, just before we got started today, I actually Googled it, and I recommend to everybody else, if you want to hear a really cool egg co-op story or a producer's co-op story, just check out that one. I find it super fascinating. So what we're going to do right now, we're going to get into the more nitty-gritty, what makes a co-op a co-op. Once again, yesterday when we were talking about this, I was saying, Seth, I actually don't understand what the difference between a co-op and a partnership is. So can you just go into what exactly makes a co-op a co-op?
Right. So a cooperative is a business that is created to meet an economic, social, or cultural need, and it's through joint ownership. So a group voluntarily comes together to meet a need by owning a business together. And the idea is that because within this group of owners, that some will benefit more than others. The assumption is that they'll all lose if this co-op doesn't exist. So to shore that up, they use democratic governance. So one member, one vote versus $1, one vote. So that would be one of the pieces making it different than a partnership or a shareholder-owned corporation. And really, I guess the other piece is that the business is created to meet a need, not solely to be only a profit-maximizing entity. So that again makes it a bit different. If we look at Battle River, if they have a tough year, they'll stay in the game because they realize it's important that the railway continues as long as the owner members need it. If it was a privately owned company, they might say, you know, we need to sell this off as soon as we can, or we're not getting enough, or we could be getting more. That will determine their decision. So really, I'd say at the core, that's kind of the piece that's in it. Very simply, though, when you mentioned compared to a partnership, is that a partnership is you need, well, three people or three members to form a co-op. Partnership, you can make it with two. So maybe that's the simple answer.
Just simple math, eh? Okay, fair enough. And I definitely know producers out there who are super interested to create a cooperative. When I'm talking to them after this show, what should I tell them? What do they need to consider, really, before they start their own co-op?
Right. So the jumping off point is two things. So one, understanding what's this common need that would be met by owning something together, and who are the members. And we can think of the members as a group of consumers, a group of producers, or perhaps a group of workers. And that's really in the broad strokes, but understanding like who are the members and what they need is the first piece. So is it a group of farmers that want to mobilize their buying power to be able to get a better deal? So buying fuel or whatever the input is, that would drive the type of co-op. On the other hand, if it's something to say, well, we need to get access to markets, or we need to own equipment together, more on the production side, then that will also change it. Anyway, to get back on track, but really once they've identified who the members are and what the need is, the next step is to go out and do some homework and really explore, is it feasible to pursue it? Are there other options that would be more cost effective? Is it too big? Do the members have the capacity and the commitment to put up the dollars and the time and the headaches that go into starting up any business together to pursue it? Once they've established that, to say, you know, it's going to be worth our while. Like even the savings that we would achieve through owning a business together, owning infrastructure, owning a train, in the long run, then based on that, they would start the incorporation process, form a founding board, figure out what the purpose of the co-op is, all the corporate documents, all the really boring stuff, and then from there get to work of meeting the needs of the members and being a strong business.
Nice, okay. And then let's say this group of producers, I know they've decided, okay, there's a definite need, we want to do this. Step number one in starting your own cooperative, and you could jump into step number two and three from there if you'd like.
Right. Yeah, no, it's definitely it might not be super linear, but I think groups to kind of give themselves the time of saying, we're in an exploratory phase. We're going to go out and we're going to answer questions or figure out the answers to these questions that work for us before making any decisions to go to the next step. Once we're comfortable with that, then being able to proceed. I think, you know, there's definitely a lot of people, probably a lot of listeners that are, you know, want everything done yesterday and they're in a hurry and they want to see results. But if you're building something that's going to, you know, be around for a couple generations, it might be worthwhile to say, well, like, let's take our time at least until we're comfortable to be able to make the next step and really, just enjoying that. There's a lot of work that could be done. And it's interesting. I think that there's a lot of solutions that are out there and some interesting examples that you could explore, without having to be hung up on one idea or one approach.
Okay, cool. And then for incorporating, I just go straight to the Service Alberta website, or how's that work exactly? All that legal mumble jumbo that I don't understand at all.
Yeah. Right. So the Service Alberta website has a section on cooperatives, and cooperatives in Alberta would be incorporated under the Alberta Cooperatives Act, or if you're going to be doing business across the country, or if you'll have members and activities in the rest of Canada, you would incorporate under the Federal Cooperatives Act. But basically, you're filling out the articles of incorporation, and that would be basically the skeleton for your co-op. And that's saying, you know, what does the co-op do? Who are the members? How many founding board members? Your name, your legal address, and that's pretty straightforward. So you would do a legal name search, put this articles of incorporation document together, and submit it. In about 2 weeks, you'll hear back from the corporate registry from Service Alberta under the co-op director of co-ops, and then you'll have a business license, and you're able to start doing the work. However, the other piece to it, and some co-ops will do this all at the same time, is the part of, I guess, putting the flesh on the bones, and that's creating the corporate documents for the co-op. And so really, you know, when you're getting started, you're saying you have a clear idea of like, what's the purpose of the co-op? What need is it going to meet? That needs to be reflected in the bylaws. And then also you need to have the members to approve those bylaws. So you have 6 months to from when you file your articles of incorporation to submitting the bylaws and having those approved by the membership. So just kind of backtracking a bit, you kind of have this outline of what the co-op's going to do. The bylaws will outline, you know, how you're going to do it, some of your policies and procedures, as well as things like how does the board make decisions? And really you want your board to be, you know, they're the ones at the helm of the ship and making the long-term strategy and the strategies for success, as well as being able to respond to the challenges. The bylaws will outline how they make good decisions, who can make decisions, and really understanding that, you know, a co-op is, you know, has a lot of members and the members are owners, the board is accountable to them. So really thinking about, you know, what the co-op is going to do and how you're going to do it, as well as being accountable to the members. And you have about 6 months. That's the time limit. But again, some will do it right off the hop and moving from there. A lot of this work will happen around the table, and at some point you might want to bring in a lawyer to make sure that your things come together. But if groups have experience setting up bylaws for other types of organizations, it shouldn't be too tricky to go for. I think we get it. I think there's a bit of a I find two approaches. Either people like fall asleep when they talk about bylaws, or they get very kind of scared that they want to pass it off to someone else. But really, like, if people can put their heads together around a document that'll work for them to be able to make their co-op basically, you know, run the way they want it to be run and be accountable to its members, then that's that piece of the work.
Fair enough. Do you mind if I ask you a slightly random question?
Please, yeah.
What's a good name for a co-op? I know most co-ops are named after the places where they're based, but is there like a rule of thumb when it comes to naming a co-op? Maybe there isn't, but I'm curious.
Right. So yeah, that's a great question. I think that also it makes it really, like, it makes it real for the cooperative.
Totally.
Right?
Yeah.
So the first part is with the corporate registry, you have to have cooperative in your name. Co-op or pool. Or union, I believe, has to be in as you register. Now, your branding and your trade name, you might not have co-op that's listed in it. That's up to the group. But the name, for one thing, you have to make sure no one else has it. So that's one starting. And yeah, it really, I think, you know, what's going to maybe tell the story. What will the group be into it? Some co-ops have gone through some rebranding where they've changed the name, but really it's something that's going to be around for a long time. So you might want to come up with something that you can live with and future members will be proud to be a part of.
All right. Yeah, something that's not too embarrassing, like Derek's Billy Goat Farm Cooperative or something like that.
That'd be great.
I'm working on it, Seth. I'm working on it. All right. One question, or at least this came from a conversation we had this past summer when I bumped into you at the Calgary Folk Fest. Something that you said really stuck out of my mind was you don't have to create a co-op to work like a co-op. No, I don't know if you remember the conversation, but could you, I swear you said it. Could you please explain what that means? So how do you function like a co-op if you're not a co-op?
Right. So yeah. And I got to take better stock of my conversations at
Folk Fest.
Yeah. But the piece, like, the co-ops are created to solve like a coordination problem, or there's a challenge in the market. So sometimes we'll see a lot of co-ops where they're responding to, you know, there's a big player, often they're a big, like a big box store, for instance, that is really using their market power to either drive other players out of the market, or that they can impact price. So it's in the rest of the businesses, the rest of the actors in the market to say, well, like, we have to team up, right? And we need to coordinate, and we need to collude. And businesses do this quite a bit. So there is something there where it's strategic to say we have a common interest, we have a common need or opportunity. Let's start to cooperate. And that could be moving from lots of things. It's building trust. So you might want to, you know, figure out what are these interactions that you can build trust that could build into larger things. So things like, you know, sharing information. If you're a business and you're getting a deal on something, why not share it with your neighbor? Now you say, well, we're competitors, but you're also competing in the market against people that are able to make that playing field unlevel, I guess. So some of those things where it's strategic to collude, that's a good place to start. So, you know, you could, for instance, if it's, you might have some other mechanisms to be able to do that in terms of like purchase agreements or certain contracts, getting a really good deal with a supplier. You might not need to form, you know, an entire cooperative to do this, but if you're behaving to say, you know, we'll all benefit from this deal, let's get in it together. What's interesting though is that from that, once it works, as long as it benefits everybody, that you might be able to see other opportunities as well. You've gotten to know the other members in the co-op in a way that's pretty strategic. So how you can build from there. I guess the last bit, it's really like what makes cooperatives work is that when people, like when the members change their behavior, when they're incentivized to work together and they're receiving those benefits. So in a co-op, you're an owner member. Being an owner means access to the profits or if there's a surplus, right? And or some savings and some benefit. If you can think of other types of arrangements where that can happen, then that might show it. Co-ops, I guess, provide a lot of good examples where you could say, you know, where can we team up and benefit where before we couldn't do it if we went on our own.
Yeah, I really liked how you said that strategic collusion. I think that strategic collusion is also good for a lot of farmers and ranchers just because we spend a lot of time working on our own. Like I could see a benefit in cooperative just being able to like interact with other human beings just on your day-to-day. Like, you know, livestock provides some company, but it's really not the same as like a conversation we're having right now. So I think for like peace of mind, there's probably huge benefits to cooperatives.
Definitely. And I think like that's like finding those opportunities to get started. And because if you're going to go further down the road into things that are bigger, if you don't have those connections, that social capital and that trust, then it's harder to make these bigger decisions. But if you trust your group and to say, you know, we're going to roll the dice on something big, we're going to buy a train or a grain elevator or solar farm. You want to have that connection. And if it's getting people together to hang out, then that's a great place to start.
Okay. And I heard you guys are doing a few events in rural Alberta the next few weeks. You want to tell us a little bit more about them?
Yeah. So we're hosting some workshops on, it's called the Energy Endurance Series. So on November 28th in Athabasca, in the town of Athabasca at their university, and then on December 12th in Drayton Valley at the Clean Energy Technology Center. And basically what we're doing is we're bringing people together that are working on community-owned renewable energy, so people that want to see maybe larger community-owned projects, and we're connecting them with pretty much every expert that is working in the community energy field. So that's lawyers that can help you set up a cooperative structure where you could actually put your RSPs and TFSAs into a solar farm, people that have done community projects, people that can get your project connected to the grid, developers, as well as a lot of people in that space. So if you have any kind of passing interest in community energy or in just renewable energy in general, definitely check it out. If you go to acca.coop, acca.coop, all the information will be there. And then we're also doing a co-op boot camp in Calgary from December 13th to the 15th. So if there's any people that are interested in learning about how to start a co-op, again, we'll have hands-on experts that can go way more in depth and way more articulate than I am on how co-ops work and how to make your cooperative business get rolling.
Dude, I think you're totally articulate. You can go into things in depth, no problem. Is there anything else that you think needs to be said about co-ops that we haven't talked about yet?
I'm trying to think. Like one of the things is that there's lots of co-ops in our community that, and they have the capacity to do some interesting things. Like we look at, you know, credit unions have billions of dollars. Our retail co-ops. And you know, if you get involved in your own cooperative, or if you're form if you're part of a producer co-op, you could bring a climate leadership plan into those organizations. You're a member owner, you have a say as well. These co-ops are going to need to keep pace with the changes, and why not get ahead of it? They're well suited to do it, and I think that there'd be a lot of value in looking at this as a resource and saying, well, I, as an owner member, I want to see this in my co-op to change. Now, you're one voice, but that kind of organizing within a co-op and really creating the demand for it, I think that they could have a lot of potential. So going it alone, starting co-ops is hard, but let's look at what's currently there in the market and talk to the branch manager of your local credit union. They might take you out for lunch and bend their ear about climate leadership and see what happens.
And I really like that democratic approach to doing business. Seth, thanks for coming in today. I know you're really busy, guys, so I really appreciate you stopping by.
Man, thank you so much for having me. This has been a blast. Thank you to Alberta Real Estate Foundation for providing financial support for this podcast. Today's episode was recorded at the Media Lab YYC in Calgary. Rural Roots to Climate Solutions is a Central Alberta-based project empowering rural Albertans with climate solutions. Along with the podcast, Rural Roots also runs workshops and farm field days. The next workshop is on January 26th in Stettler, and we will walk you through the steps of creating your own farmer cooperative. We are also hoping to have a couple producers from different farming cooperatives there that day to share their experiences. So if you like this episode and you want to find out more about co-ops, come out to Stettler on January 26th. For more details, go to the website at www.rr2cs.ca. You can also make a comment about the podcast on the website. Rural Roots to Climate Solutions is backed by an amazing advisory committee consisting of Brenda Barrett, Dana Penrose, Mark Fox, and Kim Cornish. Happy farming wherever you are in Alberta, and remember, what's good for the farm is usually good for the climate.
Nailed it.